Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 877. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, and delighted to be back with an important topic. I always like to tease the topics, but I realize that if you subscribe to this podcast, you're using your phone or you're on the website, you've already seen what the topic is. So it's difficult for me not to still try to tease the topic, but today we have a really excellent one and an excellent guest as well. Today we're going to be speaking about Christian education and the United States Supreme Court and a couple important cases from the 40s, looking at some articles written by Ned Stonehouse and using those as a launch pad into deeper issues. And to do that, we have a very distinguished guest today. We're very pleased to welcome to the program Professor Jeffrey Tuamala, who is a retired professor of law at Liberty University. He now serves adjunct there, but he was previously serving as associate dean of academic affairs, serving in the law school there at Liberty. So I'm in Libertyville. You teach at Liberty. Welcome, Jeff. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm really excited.
I'm a faithful listener.
I know.
On your Van Til series.
We love it. I know that you have been speaking with and met with our dear friend, my colleague, Ryan Noah, and this is the first time we've spoken voice-wise. We've been email corresponding, and I've been looking forward to this for months. We've had this on the calendar for a while, so I'm excited to speak about it. I'm curious also just to talk a little bit maybe about your background and leading up to your particular academic interests and legal interests and studies. But as I was looking at your CV, the light CV that Liberty has posted, I noticed you've served in the Marines, 8 years of active duty. You're served in the reserve as well. You got some ties to Ohio, so I'll keep my Michigan fandom back, as I know that you're probably a big diehard Buckeye fan as well. But I've got some of my best friends are Buckeyes, so I have high hopes for this conversation, Jeff. But I'm wondering if you might speak about some of your background, church-wise and academic-wise, and perhaps even a little bit of your interest in Van Til, because I'm sure the listeners are going to love to hear it.
Okay. Well, I got saved my last year in law school. Mm. And I had gone through officer candidate school, so I was lined up to get commissioned in the Marine Corps and serve as a judge advocate, which I did. But getting saved then really changed my life. Sure, everybody gets that.
That's the way it should be.
And practicing in the Marine Corps, I realized at some point I wanted to be doing full-time Christian ministry. And I didn't know really any more about what justice required than anybody else I was practicing with. So I thought, well, if you're going to go full-time Christian ministry, you go to seminary and you either become a pastor or work in a Christian school. And I didn't really feel a calling to be a pastor, but teaching. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I had an old Testament professor, Joseph Kikasola, who'd graduated from Westminster, was ordained in the OPC church. And he started the class, the very first class, with a relationship of law and grace. And he took from John Murray's three things law can do and two things it can't. Mm. And one thing it can't do, it can't change a person. And I realized, oh, the law is powerless to do that. Mm-hmm. So that put in my mind, there are certain things the law cannot do. There'd be jurisdictional limits on the state. And the next quarter, we were in a quarter system there. He had Greg Bonson come in to teach mm-hmm. a class on Christian theistic ethics, I think was the title of it. And we used Rush Dooney's book, Institutes of Biblical Law. Mm-hmm. And I saw theologically, there are limits on the state. And so I decided, somehow the Lord put in my mind that I would teach law. And I wasn't a prime candidate for that. So I got an LLM, an advanced degree from George Washington University. And while I was in Washington, D.C., I went to a conference where Rush Dooney was speaking. And Herbert Titus, who eventually became the dean of the law school at Regent, and he made the connection jurisprudentially to show that what I'd learned theologically was actually in the law. So he's bringing the language of law to speak to the issues that I had learned in theology. So those were the two big changes in my life intellectually. And Titus actually spoke at that point on the jurisdiction. Main point was the state has no jurisdiction over the mind. Mm. And that's at the core of the First Amendment, the religion clauses. The state has no jurisdiction over the mind. Mm-hmm. And I recently had an article published with our law review, is tax-funded education unconstitutional? And it takes and lays that out, the whole issue, very carefully, which is kind of the focus of what we're talking about here today.
I just got into a vigorous conversation with my wife this morning. We talk about these things occasionally. We send our kids to a small private Christian school. My wife works there as an administrator in enrollment and development. And so we're very much tied to it, not only by having our three children there, but by thinking about things from an administrative side of point of view. But then I think about it a lot from a theological point of view. And sometimes we're sending books over to the teachers to get them to read. Ryan and I are working hard. We have a lot of our courses now are accredited with ACSI. So we try to get some of the school teachers to take some of our Reformed Academy courses. So this is a big part of our life to think about education, and it's such an important part of our lives. And I think most people, sadly, don't ever think about the core principles of education. And they often just have this default view that the state just provides education and this is just the way things are. But that in human history, that's extremely recent. But also, it's not necessarily in most regards. There's a lot of common grace benefits. There are many. I mean, it's good that we have a general public that can add and subtract and do stuff like this and read and write. But there's a whole lot of other issues at stake that I think we don't, most people, not even Christians, think about. Do you find that to be true as well, that people are pretty uncritical regarding their views of education and how it relates to what the Bible teaches?
I think so. Back in the late 1970s, when when I became a Christian and then aware that a church in my hometown had started a Christian school. I don't think I was even married at the point, didn't have children, but I sent off a check. I thought, oh, just somehow intuitively, instinctually, I knew that was what you should, what you should be doing. I had had some time teaching in public schools. So there was nothing worked out theologically, philosophically, legally. It's just sometimes some things connect very quickly. Other times, and for other people, for various things, it takes a while to come to. And but I think people are unthinking and uncritical about these matters. And what impressed me about the Stonehouse article on the McCollum case was. He saw it. He realized what the issues were. He's articulating them. And if he were alive today, I think I could help him just tweak
improve
things
a little
bit. And he'd be ready to go. But it's really impressive that he responded that quickly on cases in the Supreme Court with the insight that he did.
Yeah, a little background. So people who've been following along might know that I'm doing some work on Ned Stonehouse. I'm very slowly but steadily and surely working to edit all of his Presbyterian Guardian articles into a collected volume. So I have them all in Word now. So I've printed some of these up and have them ready to go. And I'm reading through them closely to make sure I don't have any errors and editing necessarily, formatting, and then we'll get it off to typesetting, and it's going to take a while. But this is a major project of mine working as historian for the OPC. But there are two articles I came across that I thought were fascinating. There's tons of them in there, and several about Christian education, but there are two in which he's commenting on recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So I've included these as links in the episode description for listeners and viewers who want to read them. There are PDFs, scans of the Presbyterian Guardian. The first article is from 1947, A Differing Opinion on the School Bus Issue, in which he's speaking about Everson v. Board of Education. And in this case, the Supreme Court upheld a New Jersey law allowing public funds to reimburse parents for transportation to parochial schools. And this case was controversial because it involved public support for students attending religious schools. It's interesting, in Pennsylvania, I still think they bus kids to private school, which is kind of an interesting thing. Then the second issue, the second article, is Wither Religious Education, which Stonehouse wrote in 1948. And this addressed, as you mentioned, McCollum v. Board of Education. I was interested in that because the principal issue started in Champaign, Illinois. Champaign-Urbana is where the University of Illinois is. I drive through there when I go down hunting. So it's just about 3 hours away from where I live. But that case challenged the practice of what's called released time religious education in public schools in Champaign. And the Supreme Court ruled that the practice violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, as the public education system was assisting religious instruction. They're basically letting kids go during the day to get instruction wherever they chose. And then they were inviting various religious organizations to kind of fill the gaps. And we can get into the details of those. But before we dive into the article, or in as a preface to diving into the article, Jeff, were you familiar? I presume you were well familiar because you're familiar with all this stuff. But I mean, how familiar are these known cases? Are these very talked about? We always hear of Brown, you know, the Board of Education, and everyone, even, you know, everyone in a political speech is going to mention that. But is McCollum or Everson, are these issues or cases that people talk about today very often?
Everson is the lead case okay. In the constitutional law textbooks for Establishment Clause.
Got it.
And a reason for that is it was the case in which the Supreme Court said the First Amendment religion clauses, especially the Establishment Clause there, applies to the states through the 14th Amendment. Additionally, it's very important because I think most of the issues that have continued to be play out over the years, they're raised in Everson. And one other reason I think Everson is especially important is they spent a good deal of time dealing with the establishment controversy in Virginia from the 1780s. And they said the objectives of the First Amendment for the religion clauses are the same as those that were worked out in Virginia. So court has said, if you understand the Virginia establishment controversy and how it was resolved and the principles involved, then you'll understand the First Amendment religion clauses. And I take them on their word on that. Mm-hmm. Okay. I may not think they got the lessons of the Virginia establishment controversy right, mm-hmm. but I think the linkage is there. And it's a linkage not just because that kind of reflects this originalism that's so popular today. Well, we just look to history and tradition.
Right.
I think historically, Virginia got it right. And that's the test. So we look at history and tradition as one guide to understanding what's right, what's true. But that's not the ultimate test. Mm-hmm. I think Virginia got it right, in particular Madison and Jefferson, mm-hmm. even though I'm not always a fan of Jefferson. I think he got it right there.
I think Jefferson would have been fun to hang out with, but I agree with you. I don't think I've read some bios on him and he's an interesting guy, but yeah, I agree with you. My wife is very much partial to John Adams. And if she likes John Adams, she's not going to like Jefferson too much. What's the, are there any particular things that are important for us newbies to know? In terms of the composition of the Supreme Court of the United States in 47 and 48, or even the kinds of cases that were being taken up. Obviously, this is now just recently post-World War II. Is there anything historical, sociological, ideological? What's going on? Could you help set the stage for us so we can perhaps understand this maybe in the historical context?
Well, interestingly, Justice Black wrote the opinion in Everson. It was a 5-4 case. It was a little surprising to some people. Black had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan before he came onto the court. Mm. So here he is siding basically with the parochial schools. Yes, you can, the state, if they want to give you transportation to school, they can do that. That's not a violation of the Establishment Clause. some of the other justices, it's hard for me to speak with a lot of particularity to the background of the other justices. Mm-hmm. One, though, in particular is Robert Jackson, who was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg for the United States.
Oh, goodness.
And I went back and looked at his opening argument last night. And he talked specifically, one of the three things that Hitler was after was the churches and the church schools. So it's a little disappointing Jackson would be in the dissent on that case.
Hmm.
All right. Now, why I say disappointing is I don't think the state has a right to spend money on education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in a sense, not with the reasoning, I might agree with the dissenters there.
Sure.
But there's a general, as I put it, a friendliness towards religion and an unfriendliness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Black in the majority demonstrate a bit of friendliness, a bit of fairness. If you have to, as a taxpayer, fund the public schools, you know, isn't it at least fair to have some money going that way to help the parochial school children? And I think my guess is the first opinion piece that Stonehouse had after Everson, he's talking about this reaction of some of the conservative Protestant press is giving money to the parochial school parents is going to undermine our religious freedoms in the First Amendment. My guess is there was still something of an anti-Catholic reaction to that for fear. And he's at least certainly alluding to that in his article.
Yes. Stonehouse, you know, there were many Protestant voices, including some of Stonehouse's friends, who were strongly opposed to the decision because they viewed it as a violation of the separation of church and state. But Stonehouse, he does provide kind of an interesting and a nuanced critique where he disagreed with the oversimplified argument that public funding of transportation to religious schools constituted a proper establishment of religion. But he did argue that Protestantism should rethink its position on secular and religious education, noting that the true threat might not be Roman Catholicism, but rather the overarching secularism and statist control of education. So I think people, he's looking at a broader issue, not this specific issue of the state funding kids going to Catholic schools. He's looking at the bigger issue. And I think you can appreciate that.
For sure.
Mm-hmm.
He sees that, I think, quite clearly there. part of the, and he's wrestling with some of the issues, partly what Black is saying in his opinion is, well, this is basically general public welfare legislation, likening it to police and fire protection.
Mm.
One of the problems with that, and Stonehouse sees that, there's a problem there. Wait a second. This is different than fire and police protection. So he's got that. But for Black, he's saying, okay, this is public welfare legislation or general welfare. But he's not saying the state has to provide it. They may provide it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean the state doesn't have to provide fire and police protection? There are inconsistencies in the rationale that you have there with his opinion.
Mm-hmm. True.
It comes out friendly to religion, but it's not a principled and consistent rationale that he has.
You find that a lot, and I imagine you see this a lot in the legal profession. We see it in church courts, too, that a lot of times you might end up voting kind of against the way you would, you kind of, you're voting anti-pragmatically. So sometimes I find myself voting for something on principle because I think it's the proper thing to do according to the rules and according to the Book of Church Order, even though I won't like the outcome. You know, and in this case, I love how you're showing that there could be a friendliness to religion and you know, kind of an antipathy to religion, but at the same time, you might vote in a way that would be perceived as an antipathy to religion because you have deeper principled concerns about what the Constitution allows to begin with. That's really hard for some people to negotiate because some people want to see things at a basic level or just have it be a very short path between our actions and the desired outcome.
Yeah, that's definitely a problem. And the inconsistencies that you'll have in the rationale, even of same justices in different opinions. One of the things that I think is extremely important and is generally overlooked or tried to ignore is how is religion defined? How can you know if the state has established religion if you can't define it? Mm-hmm. The court does not define it. It really never has defined the term religion, yet in many, many cases, they found states or other government officials guilty of establishing religion. And one of the things that during the Virginia establishment controversy, Virginia set out a definition of religion. Hmm. Religion, or the duty we owe to God in the manner of discharging it. Okay, now that's pretty general in nature. And you have to look beyond that definition. Well, what has God set out exclusively to him, and what is within the jurisdiction of the state? So it's defined jurisdictionally, not theologically, not sociologically, psychologically. It's a question of what's in the jurisdiction of the state. Everything else is in the jurisdiction of your conscience, okay? And they use the terms there. So as I tell my students, whether you decide to read Curious George at bedtime to your kids or the Federalist Papers, that's a matter of conscience.
Right.
That's in the jurisdiction of religion. Okay. That's so important because as Stonehouse brings out, and I think it's maybe more clearly in that second article, he's wrestling with this distinction of secular and religious. And he says, wait a second, they're trying to divide it falsely into these basic two different realms. And religion is woven throughout the secular. Now, I wouldn't articulate it exactly that way, but what has happened is we have a private realm, that's religion, keep it there. And then there's a public realm governed by, I don't know, natural law, and right. Without the Bible, and that governs that realm, keep religion in your private realm. And I think that's a reflection of a Thomist view of theology, philosophy, that lends itself to that, because in the area of things of the realm of nature, law, government, math, whatever, we don't need scripture, just natural law. So you can send your kids to a public school and they can learn those things in the realm of nature at school, and then go to Sunday school class or catechism class after school to get your religion part of it, your realm of grace. Mm. And that comes through too with a Kantian worldview that's so affected, as Van Til points out, modernist Protestant theology. Mm-hmm. It's even worse than the Thomism because it says you may not bring Christ into the classroom. With Thomists, they would say it'd probably be a good idea, but you don't have to bring him in to get a good education. The Kantian says you must not bring him in. I think that's the basic worldview that under that tension in the court, they may not trace their view to one of those particular philosophers or theologians, but I think it's so permeated our way of thinking that that's what's driving it. And as Van Til points out, a lot of evangelicalism thinks the same way. They have a Thomist, in other words, view of things, not an ecclesiastical view, but a Thomist view in terms of natural law or theology or philosophy.
Yeah, I agree. That's fascinating to and important to discuss. Those matters of definition are really perplexing. I appreciate you sharing that definition that Virginia presented, and then we don't have a national or a federal definition of religion, which is peculiar, because if the state is not allowed to establish a religion, but we don't say what a religion is, it gets dicey. And how do we understand then this, as we understand that there is no neutrality? You know, as good Vantillians, and not just Vantill, but just as good Reformed Christians, as people who read the Bible, you know, Romans 1, there are many other places, Romans 5. There's a distinction. There's an important antithesis. We are either in Adam or we are in Christ. We are either condemned to you know, in our sins, and we are guilty and corrupt and alienated from God under the covenant of works, or we're redeemed in Christ and he's paid the penalty for our sins. And now we're redeemed and we're justified, sanctified, and adopted, and will be more so sanctified and adopted until the Lord returns. So those are the two choices. There's no middle ground. That doesn't mean there isn't a secular space, so to speak, but I'm saying there's no neutrality. And so then you have a state that has its own ends. And if the state and the people running the state are not redeemed and they're not thinking God's thoughts after him in a created level and seeking to honor and glorify him as leaders, we know that they have a proper authority. We know that the Lord has appointed them to their position. And there's all sorts of respect, honor, and duty and obedience due to the state insofar as they're not leading us to break God's commandments. But there's this issue where so many people, Supreme Court justices included, just believe that there is a level of neutrality, or that secularism or atheism, for example, are not religiously motivated. They're just the absence of religion. And that leads to all sorts of faulty reasoning and faulty decisions in the Supreme Court case. I wonder if you could comment on that, just the notion of atheism and secularism, and because it seems that even in Virginia's definition, there's just a presupposition and a presumption that everyone acknowledges that there is a God. You might have different ideas of what God is, but to find someone who's an atheist is really quite unusual. Many, many years ago, we've read books on that, but I'll leave it to it. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that specific issue and how it's refracted in the legal space.
Well, there's a tendency, there's a footnote, fairly famous footnote in the Tricasso case that says, oh, there are other religions that don't have a belief in God in a traditional, more traditional Christian sense, and it lists secular humanism and some other things.
Yeah.
So people will say, those are religions, they're establishing religion. That's true, but I'm defining, and I think properly, in terms of legally, it's jurisdictional. What belongs in the jurisdiction of the state?
Mm-hmm.
Those things Madison said that can be backed by force or violence.
Yes.
Everything else is a matter of reason and conviction. Okay. So religion, that definition in Virginia, I think is a proper definition for religion when we're in a legal context. What belongs to the state? In other words, Caesar. God tells us what belongs to Caesar. Now, that's hard to figure out sometimes. It's there. Yeah. If it doesn't belong to Caesar, it's in the realm of conscience or religion.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be backed up by force. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, we owe all our duties. All our duties are owed to God,
mm-hmm.
but there are some duties that we owe to God. When we break those, the state can punish him.
Correct.
Others, they're in the realm of conscience, maybe the family, maybe the church, you know, mm-hmm. to have certain jurisdiction over there.
Mm-hmm.
That is the critical point that is missed.
Mm-hmm.
And the Virginia statute on religious freedom, which is the law in Virginia, by the way, mm-hmm. still, they would never get rid of one of Thomas Jefferson's handiworks, is that Almighty God has created the mind free. It's free. The state can't tell you what to think.
Correct.
Can't tell you what to say.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't even be telling you what to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
That goes to at the heart of school, the schooling. Now he goes a step further and he says in there, and this is adopted by Virginia. So it's not just Jefferson. This is the mind of Virginians, is that to tax a person for the propagation of opinions they don't believe is sinful and tyrannical.
Mm-hmm.
When you tax somebody for the public schools that teach things you don't believe, or Jefferson goes on to say, even that you do believe, that's sinful and tyrannical. That language of sinful and tyrannical, the court has quoted many times, even in recent years, but they don't see the inconsistency. So for example, a teacher, a public school teacher, can't be forced to pay union dues. And Justice Alito says, he quotes Jefferson, to force a man to pay for things he doesn't believe is sinful and tyrannical. Yet he doesn't see the inconsistency. The state can force you to pay taxes for that public school teacher. He doesn't see the sinfulness and tyrannicalness out of there. There's a disconnect. It's really quite breathtaking.
Yeah, it is. So I got a lot of questions. I love this conversation. We're getting down to it. And these are the kinds of things that Ryan and I speak about. We get fired up and have good talks about thinking about a better society. This is when we're at the pub and we're debating on buying one of these $1 plots in Detroit and starting our own utopia. Because those utopia plans always work out well, don't they, Jeff?
Yeah, especially in Detroit.
I guess so. But a couple questions here, and I want to keep this conversation going because this is really getting interesting. It all has been interesting, but now we're really getting interesting. So we got an issue here. I love the way you define this. All of our duty and everything we do and have, is owed unto God. We're called to be good stewards of everything that we have and everything that we do. There's nothing that we do that's not before God and accountable to Him. Yet there are different jurisdictions and some might say spheres, if we go back to Kuiper and other people, to speak about their different proper jurisdictions in which there can be punishments or corrections when we do disobey. Now, we're always before God, and God will be the ultimate judge of all things. But if I kill a man, that's the proper jurisdiction of the state to punish me and to take care of restraining, promoting justice and restraining wickedness. And that's their God-given duty. But I'm asking the question, I guess I can ask this at two levels. One, theologically, but I want to ask this first off as a U.S. citizen or a state citizen, whatever state you want to choose, Virginia, Illinois. How do you proceed when the state has stepped outside of its jurisdiction, but yet the Supreme Court, whether at the state level or the Supreme Court at the federal level, who is properly understood, and we all agree in the Constitution that they interpret the Constitution and the law, so they're the ultimate legal authority from a governmental perspective. What happens when they endorse that stepping outside the bounds? We're left with this problem here where you and I might have views of the state doing things that is not given the legal right to do, but yet they're doing them. And then the court that's deciding whether they're doing it correctly is saying, yes, they are. So how do we negotiate that as citizens, other than, I suppose, the long-term process of voting for different people who have different ideas?
Okay. Well, as a basic approach, take what Peter said when he was told he couldn't preach. Well, we have to obey God.
Right.
And I take that as a principle. If the state tells you to do something that's a sin, that you would be sinning to do it, then you have to disobey the state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're actually obeying the law.
Right.
Now, if they're sinning against you, taxing you where it has no power and shouldn't be, you pay your taxes. Unless, I suppose, the tax became so burdensome you couldn't do your other duties like tied to the church.
Feed your family.
Take care of your family. Mm-hmm. Okay. So as a general principle that way.
So in this sense, we're seeing the state as sinning against us under this view, but we are not being caused to sin necessarily unless it got so burdensome. So that is there's
Correct.
A different, just to clarify for everyone. Sure.
Okay. Now, there's another issue here before getting on to who do you vote for and do we have standing? Can we bring a lawsuit?
Yeah.
Something of that nature.
Sure.
It's the Christian magistrate. Okay. And this played out in Alabama about 20 years ago. You may have remembered with Chief Justice Moore on the Alabama Supreme Court, who put a Ten Commandments monument in the judicial building there. And eventually they said, you've established religion. You're basically, they kicked him off the court. Now, people said, you must obey the civil magistrate. He is the civil magistrate. He has a duty to God. He's got a dual appointment, one from the citizens of Alabama who voted for him. The other is from God. He's been commissioned by God. He has a duty to enforce the law to the best of his ability when other magistrates are ordering him not to. Right? So he's, I think, properly in a position of, he's not the citizen who's been sinned against. He's a civil magistrate who has a duty to enforce the law.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Very much like a soldier or Marine mm-hmm. who has a duty not to obey an unlawful order. So there's a distinction that's often missed there. So some Christians will say, well, if you can't go along with the court that's telling you to do something too illegal, what you should do is just resign or recuse yourself from the case. I don't think that that's, I mean, you can, but I don't think that's really the proper answer. Now, I'd like to bring up something. I attended and spoke at a Christian Education Initiative conference this last weekend that was quite good. And there was a recurring theme there about pastors.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to go into that too far, but quite often in our system, the people are sovereign as we read things. So we have certain duties. And if we fail in those duties, we have to repent.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to tell us when we failed in our duties, okay, as citizens? So I think that the jurisdiction, the teaching authority of the church is much broader than probably most pastors see it at, unless our theory of government is wrong and the people really aren't sovereign. We don't have any duties in that area that we need to perform or repent of if we don't. Now, I don't want to turn pulpits into, you know, political science classes and things of that nature, but I think there has to be some thought that's broader. I think implicitly there's this Kantian Thomist view that there's some privatized area, at least small area for religion, and that's proper. Now, maybe it's not in the pulpit, but in teaching. And I think that's especially where Christian schools and colleges and universities have a real role to play.
Mm-hmm. Now, some people have a really it's difficult for people to understand what the world might look like or what the United States might look like if there was no tax-funded, state-sponsored education. You know, when I talk about this idea, just in having a conversation once in a while, or even with my wife, sometimes the knee-jerk reaction of some can be, well, kids need to be educated. So that, for me, that's a different issue. Like we're not saying we shouldn't educate everyone. The suggestion is whether the state ought to do it, because the state doesn't have a right to tell you what to think and to influence you in that regard. So How are we to, what are some general principles and that might be a better way to think about how education might go forward in a way that would not transgress our First Amendment, but even more so, more importantly, that would be properly understood from within a Christian worldview and in a Reformed theological construct? I'm wondering, you know, you've thought a lot about this and have thought about this for a long time. What are, you know, we can critique the way things are, but if we were to have the freedom to just redo the entire system one day, not saying that day would come, but if you had the freedom and you were in a position to draw up a new way that the United States did or did not do education, what do you think would be more proper?
Well, I think, first of all, return to a proper understanding of the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And once again, I'm not an originalist on that.
Mm.
I believe there's God's law of nature, put it that way, to kind of distinguish it from a Thomist view of natural law,
mm-hmm.
that governs. And things don't get changed overnight. And definitely as Christians, I think we're not calling for a revolution, tearing things in that sense, tearing down.
Mm-hmm.
The school systems are collapsing. That's clear. And we have to have in place schools and education and know how to educate that's different than public schooling with some prayer heaped on top of it.
Right.
So that, you know, when the time comes, we've got it there where we can do these things. The amount of waste that goes into public schooling and other things. Somebody asked me this question at a law review symposium we had. Well, who's going to educate all the kids in, I use Cleveland, Ohio,
yeah,
because they're at the very bottom of things.
Mm.
Who's educating them now? Look in this country at all the stadiums, sports arenas, on and on and on, the money that goes into those from Christian universities and schools as well.
Mm-hmm.
And do you mean we can't fund a basic education?
Mm-hmm. Well, also think people. if no one was ever taxed how much for education. Look at my property taxes here. They're insane. If we had that money, that easily would cover the tuition that it costs.
And then the question is, that money saved, are Christians going to use that to go on a cruise in the Caribbean or to Disney World?
Right.
Or are they going to have a school,
yeah,
and bring in others that, is a chance for evangelism,
yeah,
as
right,
well as just education. Yeah. It seems to me, this conference I went to, one of the presenters was, her name was Lee Bortons from Classical Conversations, and the suggestions and what they've got going on. There are some extremely creative, thoughtful, energetic people out there that are doing things that are going to provide, I think, some real answers and solutions and programs that are in place.
Mm.
People that are putting these things in place, I see my role more here as, okay, what is the proper legal construct here?
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that government officials might see that. People that believe in Christian education may see, oh, there's a real principled basis for what we're doing here.
Mm-hmm.
We're not just trying to solve a crisis of the lack of moral content in our education and so on, but
mm-hmm.
this is something that we're supposed to be doing, and the state is not.
Absolutely. Now, I lived in Pennsylvania for 5 years. They have an interesting setup, and they have quite a few charter schools. So these would be, and Illinois has a handful too. There's one just down the street here that's actually quite a decent school. It's not a Christian school, so it's not that great, but the charter school system is different, in which the state might allow a school, give grant to them a charter, and those schools are run like self-contained businesses, but they, and so they're not public schools properly speaking, but they have more freedom and flexibility. The question I have, you know, some people might say, well, what if we just got rid of public school education and just granted charters? You still end up with this issue where, or if you're doing a voucher system, or if certain people are excused from paying taxes towards education if they're sending their kids somewhere else. There's all these issues where you still end up with state oversight, right? Where the state is going at some point to have to decide whether such an education is legitimate. And then, you know, then you have end up with the state, in my opinion, stepping on the bounds and stepping out of its jurisdiction into the jurisdiction of the family, who should have a ultimate decision in terms of how to educate and raise their kids. Have there been any other Supreme Court cases on this particular issue? I don't know, with charter schools or other issues where the state is the one deciding. I know there have been many homeschool issues where in Illinois, you still, even if you homeschool your kids, you have to submit to various forms of state testing and everything to satisfy the state that the child is actually getting educated. But even in that regard, you still have the family being bound to the state's decisions on what is or is not acceptable for education. What are some principles or perhaps either, you know, legal precedents in the U.S. that have informed some of these issues?
Okay. The main case that would come to mind would be the Zelman case. Hmm. And that had to deal with a system that Cleveland, Ohio had set up, or the state of Ohio did, but it was for Cleveland because it was such a disaster there. They set up several different options. One is that you could go to a private school, religious or non-religious, mm-hmm. and they would give a voucher of, seems to me it was approximately $2,500, which mm-hmm. wouldn't cover the whole cost of an education. And that was challenged. And the court said there was no compulsion on the students to go there. They were basically trying to give some parity between private schooling and public schooling, and they upheld that by a 5-4 decision. Mm. Now, there have been some other cases in recent years, one dealing with funds for rubberized playgrounds, okay, a Trinity Lutheran case. Another one, Espinoza in Montana, that had to deal with setting up these tuition organizations where you could put money in and they could give it to various schools.
Oh, Illinois got something like that. The Catholics helped pass that. We had a fund like that, okay. Kind of like a public fund where you could divert. You get tax credit for putting into this scholarship fund and then a student could draw on that.
Yes. And basically, as long as they set those up so they can go to private religious or private non-religious, that's okay, but you have to treat those both equally. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to treat the private schools equally to the funding to public schools. Mm-hmm. They've never gone that way, even though the court has frequently said under the First Amendment, government must be neutral between religion and religion and between religion and non-religion. They definitely are not there with public schools. But that principle is in place, and some other cases like Zelman that suggests that a state, if it wants, could equally fund public and private, religious, non-religious, charter vouchers, whatever. But that would still violate the principle, I think God has created the mind free. Mm-hmm. It's sinful and tyrannical to tax a person to pay for opinions they don't believe. Mm-hmm. Now, there are the pragmatic questions. If you go with charter schools and vouchers, they're going to control you. Those are the pragmatic issues, and they're very real.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yes.
But what I'm setting is, and I think is a proper understanding, is a principled basis why the court shouldn't be doing that. Now, interestingly, and a lot of people don't see this or know this, the Virginia establishment controversy started after the Revolutionary War. Patrick Henry realized, whoa, morals have really declined here in Virginia. We need to do something about it. Okay. The Anglicans were no longer the established church. Presbyterians and the Baptists said, sure, we'll fight the revolution, but quit taxing us for your church, okay? Then after the war, Patrick Henry makes this proposal, and the Baptists and Presbyterians says, hey, we can get in on this too. Madison's alarmed by this. So he writes his memorial and remonstrance against tax assessments. Jefferson's already written this bill for establishing religious freedom. Patrick Henry's bill was, you can decide what church, and there wasn't a clear distinction between church and school, but it was for educational purposes. You decide which church, pastor, whatever it goes to. And if you don't have a church you want it to go to, it can go to the state, the county commissioners, and they can set up a school. Okay. And Virginia rejected that.
Oh,
no. They rejected the voucher system. Okay. I think the Supreme Court would probably, the way they're going, would uphold vouchers, but that would be a violation, I believe, of the Establishment Clause just as surely as funding only public schools.
Just to put a, maybe put a cap on that, maybe just for people to, for you to repeat this case, if you could simplify or help us to understand, why would you see, I don't disagree, I'm just asking for a summary. Why would you see a voucher system? We have them in Indiana, just next door to us. Why is a voucher system, in your view, a violation of the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause?
Because education is in the jurisdiction of religion. That's an establishment of religion when you pay for education.
Even when they're paying back, the whole principle of the state controlling, taking those funds and then controlling them, that itself is outside
the property. They're going to control those funds, as you pointed out, and how they're used.
Oh, they absolutely do. Yes, of course. So there's a deeper issue too, and not just there's an issue with vouchers, because that also directs how the schools behave and act. There's all sorts of byproducts that are not good that we've seen, even with Christian schools in Indiana, as I've been talking to various people who send their kids to those schools. On the surface, it seems like a really great thing. Oh, I could get these vouchers from the state and I can save money and then I can send my kids to the Christian school. But then there's always, it never comes without strings, and not just strings, but perhaps unintended side effects. So there's a deeper issue here with the state taxing for education to begin with.
Correct.
Gotcha.
There's a principle, not just a pragmatic concern.
Right, right. And then there's all sorts of other issues that come on the heels of that. So are there any other particular issues there or things that you think we ought to talk about, whether McCollum and Everson or beyond? I mean, we've gone much wider than just those two particular issues. But surely there are some things that I'm not thinking about or that I'm missing, or other particular cases or principles that the listeners would be interested to hear and would help them?
Well, one of the points that Stonehouse brings up in the McCollum article.
We should say, yeah, the release time education, that, so just to remind people, so there was an issue, I believe it was a Hindu woman or something, it wasn't a Christian necessarily, down at Champaign. Vashti McCollum, I think her name was, but they were letting, Champaign was letting students out during the day to get educated by other religious groups, but it wasn't compulsory, but it ended up being a default kind of situation where whatever else the state was going to do with that time ends up being kind of the default that was making somebody unhappy about this.
Well, they were released, but it was in the school building.
Yes.
Okay. A subsequent case a couple of years later, Zorak, they allowed him to go off campus.
Oh, so it's the same thing.
The only difference. And that was okay.
Not
on the campus. Yes.
Oh,
and
okay.
And still today, you will find some schools that, especially in Utah, where the Mormons will have some kind of building across the street to facilitate going over for release time.
Oh, okay. So the principal issue, at least as the Supreme Court's thinking about it now, is the fact they were doing it on site. Oh, okay. I get it.
That was the difference.
Okay. So you were saying, I interrupted you, but just to summarize that again, but what was the particular issue we ought to address here with Stonehouse and his views on McCollum?
Well, he takes up Frankfurter's, it was a concurring opinion there.
Hmm.
And basically Frankfurter is justifying the opinion of McCollum, shutting down the release time. And he says schools are so important. It's the most pervasive means of promoting our common destiny.
Yes.
That's necessary to secure and maintain a democratic society. It's the most powerful agency for promoting cohesion among a heterogeneous Democratic Party.
Right.
Is there divisiveness in our country today?
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to solve it?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a threat to democracy? How are we going to solve it? And Stonehouse is saying, whoa, that language is going to result, or we've already got a statism issue of the government taking over everything. The way some of the Supreme Court decisions are written in a lot of areas that involve fundamental rights, say free exercise of religion, is the state can actually override your free exercise right if it has a compelling interest and there's no other way of achieving it. Is there a compelling interest in saving democracy and stopping divisiveness in this country? They would say, yes. Is there any other way to do that than compulsory education in state schools? No. He sees that coming there.
Yeah.
That's why I think him lighting on that language. Jackson, in a famous case of West Virginia versus Board of Education versus Barnett, they said that you can't force a student to do a Pledge of Allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we all got that. Jackson writes there, if there's one fixed star in our constitutional constellation, is that no official, high or petty, shall dictate what shall be orthodox in matters of politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion. Education is all about saying what's orthodox in matters of opinion and what's important, but yet then Jackson will be opposed to, he'll take a different position and say, well, of course the state can set up schools, even though he said no orthodoxy of opinion. The Supreme Court loves to quote that language from Jackson's opinion in Barnett. Frankfurter dissented there. No, in the sake of national unity and so on, you can force these students to say the Pledge of Allegiance. You can send their parents to jail if they don't.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you've got there with Frankfurter.
Yeah,
he's responding to that. And that kind of mentality, these things never go away. They come back up over and over again. They're never settled, it seems to me, mm-hmm. once and for all.
So Stonehouse is really keyed in and understanding this well. You appreciate his homing in on that particular issue. Are there other things you think that Stonehouse maybe is missing, or as you mentioned, if you were alive today, or we could go back in time, or what might you want to discuss with him on this case, or perhaps the other?
I'd want to go over the definition of religion,
uh-huh.
and that this is a jurisprudential definition, not religious, not sociological, and so on.
Yeah,
and I think instinctively he's got that. Oh, there's some things the state does not have jurisdiction over. And I'd point him to the Virginia statute establishing religious freedom.
Yeah.
God has created the mind free. It's sinful and tyrannical to tax on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got he's dealing with this issue, the difference between religious and secular. The Supreme Court's Establishment Clause jurisdiction makes a big deal about the difference between religious and secular. Okay. They don't define secular either. But it's come to be that's this area, secular religion is not allowed. Religious, private, keep it there. He sees there's a problem with that. Now, a traditional or classical definition of secular is simply that which is in the realm of time, the temporal. So in the Catholic Church, you have secular priests, not because they're gambling. I think that is okay, as long as it's bingo. But it's not that they're non-religious. It's that they're the parish priests that are dealing with people and all their problems in the homilies and the Eucharist and so on. They've changed the meaning of secular from simply time-bound to something that says it becomes a question of authority. God has no authority over the secular, okay? Only over the religious, and that's the private realm. So to have a proper to see that this is a false bifurcation between religious and secular, which is at the heart of the Supreme Court cases. Now, what they're trying to do is they don't like that test. It's called the Lemon test. And they kind of insinuate that Lemon is overruled and it's out, and that somehow all the problems can be solved by history and tradition. Okay. And I'd ask them, okay, what's the history and tradition of a high school football coach praying on the 50-yard line after the game is over? Now, let's see. Back in the late 1700s, I don't think they were playing football. I don't think they had high school coaches. I don't think they had public schools. So what's the answer? Historically, if we're originalists, well, it's going to come back to this. They were basically friendly to religion back then. Okay. It's this question of what level of generality are you going to answer questions at? This extreme level of generality or particulars. And that's one of the wonderful things about scripture. And I realized in my teaching is the moral realm is ordered from generals to particulars. Two great commandments, the Ten Commandments, all the law and the prophets. So instead of just being there with some very general principle or law that you can, you know, argue almost any content in it, with scripture, we have lots of particulars there to keep us on track so that we can have a belief in a corpus juris, a systematic theology. Generals relate to the particulars and to one another's, that there's actually in the law, a body of law, corpus juris, that comes out of a Christian philosophy of law that goes back and gets solidified very strongly, actually, in the 11th and 12th centuries.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I feel like I'm going to start taking some courses on this. I'm really interested in these ideas. It's really tremendous. I'm wondering, I mean, are there certain things you might point people toward, either particular books, people that haven't gone to law school, or how might they get started on thinking about some of these basic issues? Do you either have articles or books yourself that are available to people, or where might you send people who would like to follow up and think more critically about these matters?
Okay. I've put this out. My thinking really is a development of and reflection of Herbert Pytus, who was the founding dean at Regent University. And there are a lot of his talks online, I think maybe even sermons online and various other places that are out there that are very good. I've taken it, I think, put it in the most systematic, complete format in an article that I wrote for the Liberty Law Review that's readily available online. You don't have to pay for it or anything. It's
we'll
just there
to
download. And so the article is my name, Jeffrey C. Tamala. Is tax-funded education unconstitutional? Or is it constitutional, I should say? All right. And it's in volume 18 of the Liberty University Law Review. And it's a lengthy article. It's over 100 pages, but it goes carefully through this. sets out the history, in particular in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It shows the inconsistency with Jefferson Madison when eventually they become promoters of public school in the University of Virginia, and then sets out to explain the worldview that's involved that explains this secular religious dichotomy. And then the last nearly 20 pages, so often, and at least circles I run in, Christian worldview. You say, here's my position. That's the Christian worldview.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, so the last 20 pages is setting out biblically why education has to be Christian, and then why the state has no jurisdiction over it.
Hmm.
So I'm bringing, at least to the best of my abilities, the biblical justification there, not just leaving it at these general principles that I think are correct, but people haven't necessarily set up a biblical defense of those.
Oh, wonderful. We'll certainly include a link to that article as well. And I've read good portions of that article. I haven't finished all 100 pages yet. I feel like I need to read slowly. So this might be my fire pit reading for this evening. It's a Friday as we record, so I'm looking forward to a nice, pleasant weekend. And certainly we'll be thinking about many of these issues as we wrap up. But Jeff, this has been such a pleasure. I hope this is an entree or a prelude of other conversations to come, especially as we receive many other people, comments, feedback, as people watch and listen to this, as they have their own issues. I'm sure that there'll be a million other things that will arise, but at least as an introduction, as a first foray into some of these issues on our program, Christ the Center, this has been a true joy, and I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Well, I've enjoyed being on. My guess is probably non-Christians aren't going to be watching or paying attention to it. Christians, especially lawyers, expect some resistance to it.
Yeah.
And if somebody wanted to have a discussion on a podcast, I'd be more than happy to
oblige. Could do more of that. We can maybe have our own symposium. We could talk about these issues. And I actively solicit our listeners and viewers, if you have thoughts or follow-up or suggestions for future episodes or perhaps a live session, whether that's a symposium or colloquium or convivium, all these fun Latin words, whatever you want, I'd be interested to explore those things. So you can send your information, your questions and suggestions in to mail@reformedforum.org. We also have community.reformedforum.org still running, our mighty network there. And of course, you can try to get a hold of us through our accounts on Instagram and Twitter X as well. You'll find information about Professor Tamala's writings and his background at the link on the episode description to his entry at Liberty. Of course, we'll have a link to his article there, as well as links to and PDFs that you can download of the two articles by Stonehouse that we've spoken about today. And of course, we're online at reformedforum.org, where you will find information about all of our programs, our publications, events, and other things going on. Please subscribe to our email newsletter. That's the best way for you to stay in touch and updated about what we're up to. And hopefully we'll be able to come to your area sometime with some meetups and other things. But I do want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.